He told Kamiyawe that in the morning he wished to purchase 20 additional horses. Kamiyawe pointed out that his people had lost a great number of their horses to the Blackfeet, but said he would see what he could do. He also said he thought the old man who had once crossed the mountains with the Nez Perce would be willing to guide Lewis and Clark. Matters being thus far arranged, Lewis ended his journal entry for the day, I directed the fiddle to be played, and the party danced very merrily, much to the amusement and gratification of the natives, though I must confess that the state of my own mind at this moment did not well accord with the prevailing mirth, as I somewhat feared that the caprice of the Indians might suddenly induce them to withhold their horses from us, without which my hopes of prosecuting my voyage to advantage was lost. The Indians were ready to sell, but the captains discovered over the next few days that the price had gone up considerably. The Shoshones had a captive, desperate market. It was perfectly clear to them that the white men had to have horses, come what may. On August 29th, Clark found that he had to offer his pistol, a knife, and 100 rounds of ammunition for one horse. The captains had tried to make it a strict rule never to reduce their arsenal, but now they had no choice. Eventually, the captains bought 29 horses, but as James Ronda puts it, the Shoshones had proven to be better Yankee traders than the Americans. When Clark examined the horses in his corral, he found them to be nearly all sore backs and several poor and young. The captains had bought the cast-offs of the Shoshone herd. Chapter 23. Over the Bitter Roots, September 1st to October 6th, 1805. The party set out early on September 1st, traveling cross-country over high, rugged hills to today's North Fork of the Salmon River, Fish Creek to Lewis and Clark, following the Shoshone guide, whom the captains called Old Toby. They were headed almost due north and climbing toward the Continental Divide, on their right to the east, in rough, seldom-traveled mountainous country, with no Indian trail or any other sign of human presence. They were entering mountains far more difficult to pass than any American had ever attempted. The country is so remote and rugged that nearly two full centuries later, it remains basically uninhabited. The confusion of creeks and ravines cutting through the steep mountainsides has made the route the expedition used one of the most disputed of the entire journey. One expert, Harry Majors, calls the route the single most obscure and enigmatic of the entire Lewis and Clark expedition. Clark described the route. Through thickets in which we were obliged to cut a road, over rocky hillsides where our horses were in perpetual danger of slipping to their certain destruction, and up and down steep hills with the greatest difficulty, risk, etc., we made 7.5 miles. As the party ascended toward the divide, the going grew worse. On September 3rd, it snowed. The last thermometer broke. Clark summed up the misery of the day. We passed over immense hills and some of the worst road that ever horses passed. Our horses frequently fell. There was no game in the mountains, save grouse. The expedition consumed the last of its salt pork. At least they got to the divide, whether at Lost Trail Pass or Chief Joseph Pass is disputed, which they followed for some miles along the present Idaho-Montana border before beginning their descent to the Bitterroot Valley west of the divide. There was a hard freeze that night. On September 4th, the party fell down a very steep descent to a north-flowing river that Lewis named Clark's River, today's Bitterroot River. There, at today's Ross's Hole, the captains encountered a band of the Salish Indians, some 400 people strong, with at least 500 horses. The Salish, whom the captains called Flatheads, a generic term with them, loosely used to signify all Northwest Indians, even though they did not deform their heads as Indians on the Columbia did, were friendly. The presence of Old Toby undoubtedly helped ease the way for the Americans, for the Salish were allies of the Shoshones. Indeed, this band was on its way to join Kamiyawate's people at the Three Forks. Communication was possible if cumbersome. A Shoshone boy lived with the Flatheads. He could speak with the captains through the usual translation channels. As he habitually did with previously unknown Indians, Lewis made a vocabulary of the Salish language, taking special care in this instance because the Indians' throaty, guttural speech led him to conjecture that they were descendants of Prince Madoc and the Welsh Indians. Like many others, Jefferson believed that this persistent myth might well be true and had instructed Lewis to look for the tribe. The Salish were not Welsh, but they were, in Private Joseph Whitehouse's words, "the likeliest and honestest savages we have ever yet seen." They were also generous. Although their stock of provisions was as low as that of the expedition, they shared their berries and roots. And they traded for horses at much better prices than the Shoshones demanded, perhaps not aware of how desperate Lewis and Clark were. The captains bought 13 horses for a few articles of merchandise, and the Salish were kind enough to exchange 7 of the rundown Shoshone ponies for what Clark called elegant horses. The expedition now had approximately 39 horses, 3 colts, and 1 mule, for packing, riding, or food in the last extreme. On the morning of September 6th, the captains directed the men to lighten the loads on the Shoshone horses and pack the excess on the Salish horses. By mid-afternoon, that task was completed, and the party set off down the Bitterroot River north, while the Salish galloped out for Three Forks and the buffalo hunt. The expedition made 10 miles and camped, with nothing to eat but 2 grouse and some berries. The captains were out of flour and had in the larder only a little corn and the portable soup Lewis had purchased in Philadelphia. For the next 3 days, the descent of the wide and beautiful Bitterroot Valley was relatively easy. The expedition made 22 miles on the 7th, 23 on the 8th, and 21 on the 9th. But as they marched, the captains and their men kept looking to their left, west, at the snow-covered Bitterroot Mountains, described by Sergeant Patrick Gass as "the most terrible mountains I ever beheld." The barrier would have to be crossed. How, they could hardly imagine. The Bitterroot was wide enough to be floated in canoes, but the captains never thought of stopping to make the craft and becoming waterborne again. When they asked Old Toby about its course, he could only inform them that it continued to flow north as far as he knew it, and he did not know whether it joined the Columbia River or not. It did, but far to the north. In any case, the absence of salmon on the river told the captains that there had to be a great falls downstream. Making further geographical inquiries of Old Toby, Lewis learned that a few miles downstream, just west of today's Missoula, Montana, the Bitterroot was joined by another river, today's Clark Fork, that flowed from the Continental Divide through an extensive valley. If a party went up the Clark Fork to its source, it could cross the divide over a low pass and would then descend down a gentle road to the Missouri River near the gates of the Rocky Mountains. According to Old Toby, "a man might pass to the Missouri from hence by that route in 4 days." 4 days. It had taken the expedition 53 days to travel from the gates of the Rocky Mountains to its present location. Whatever emotions Lewis felt when he learned that the party might have saved 7 weeks, he kept to himself. The party camped the night of September 9th at the junction of a stream coming in from the west, today's Lolo Creek, some 10 miles south-southwest of Missoula. Old Toby informed Lewis that at this place the party would leave the Bitterroot River and head almost straight west up Lolo Creek and then over the mountains. The ordeal that every man had dreaded every time he looked left was about to begin. Lewis wrote of "those unknown formidable snow-clad mountains," which the party was about to attempt, "on the bare word of a savage, Old Toby, while 99/100th of his countrymen assured us that a passage was impracticable." "The weather appearing settled and fair," Lewis wrote, "I determined to halt the next day, rest our horses, and take some celestial observations." He called the campground Traveler's Rest. On the morning of September 10th, Lewis sent out all the hunters. They returned with 4 deer, a beaver, and 3 grouse. Even more welcome, if possible, Private John Coulter brought in 3 Indians from a tribe that lived across the mountains. The captains called them flatheads, but they were almost surely Nez Perce. They were in pursuit of a band of Shoshones that had stolen 21 horses, proof that the mountains could be crossed. One of the 3 agreed to remain with the Americans to introduce us to his relations, whom he informed us were numerous and resided in the plain below the mountains on the Columbia River, from whence he said the water was good and capable of being navigated to the sea. He also told Lewis that some of his relation were at the sea last fall and saw an old white man who resided there by himself. The best news of all, Lewis recorded, was that the Indian said it would require 5 sleeps, which is 6 days' travel, to reach his relations. 6 days' travel wasn't so bad. Perhaps those mountains were not so formidable as they appeared. Further inquiry revealed that the river that flowed into the Bitterroot a few miles north, today's Clark Fork, received a smaller stream, today's Blackfoot, some little distance to the east, near the site of today's Missoula, and that it was this stream the Nez Perce followed to get to a low pass over the Continental Divide, bringing them to the Buffalo Country in the vicinity of either the Dearborn or the Medicine, today's Sun, River. That news confirmed that there were 2 mountain crossings required to get to the Missouri drainage from the Nez Perce country west of the Bitterroot Mountains, and it told the captains that there were at least 2 better routes across the Continental Divide than the one they had taken, one via today's Clark Fork to today's McDonald Pass, 6,320 feet, down to today's Helena, a second via the Blackfoot River to today's Lewis and Clark Pass, elevation 6,000 feet exactly, down to the Great Falls, and a possible third via Gibbons Pass, 6,941 feet, down the Wisdom River to the Jefferson River. Which of these answered Jefferson's order to find the most direct and practicable water communication across this continent, only exploration would tell. It was much too late in the season to contemplate side journeys at this time. The entire party had to press on to the west, to the Pacific. Come next summer, on the return trip, they could examine the alternate routes. For now, the requirement was to get over the bitter routes before the fall snows began. During the night of September 10th to 11th, 2 horses strayed. Not until 3 o'clock p.m. were they caught and brought in, so the expedition could get started up Lolo Creek on the Nez Perce Trail across the mountains, called today the Lolo Trail. It was an expensive delay. The Indian who had volunteered to guide the expedition to his people got impatient and took off. The party made 7 miles and camped. In the morning, Lewis found that his horse had strayed. He remained behind to search for it while Clark proceeded. On arrival at a hot springs that sprouted from the rocks and which was nearly boiling hot, today's Lolo Hot Springs, Clark waited for Lewis to come up. When he arrived, the party followed what Clark called a tolerable route that crossed the divide, separating the Bitterroot drainage from the waters flowing east. A couple of miles east of today's Lolo Pass, they came to a beautiful open glade, today's Packer Meadows. Continuing, the expedition fell down today's Pack Creek, Glade Creek to Lewis and Clark, and camped. Clark described the road west of the divide as very fine, level, open, and firm. Although the mountains stretched to the west as far as the eye could see, hopes were high. If the Indian informant was right, and if the road continued fine, in 4 days the expedition would be through the Bitterroots. But on September 14th, it rained, hailed, and snowed. Worse, old Toby got lost. The Nez Perce Trail followed the ridgeline, north of the river the captains called the Kooskooskee, today's Loxa, but old Toby led the party down the drainage to a fishing camp on the Kooskooskee. Indians had recently been there, and their ponies had eaten all the grass. Bad luck for the expedition. The road was much worse than yesterday, excessively bad and thickly strewed with falling timber, steep and stony. By the time the men made camp, near today's Powell Ranger Station, they and the horses were much fatigued and famished. Since the hunters had been unsuccessful, we were compelled to kill a colt to eat and named the South Fork Colt Killed Creek. On the 15th, the party followed the Kooskooskee downstream 4 miles, where old Toby recognized his mistake and led the men up today's Wendover Ridge on the north side of the river toward the ridgeline. The going was incredibly difficult. It was a steep ascent made worse by the immense quantity of falling timber. Several of the horses slipped and crashed down the hills. The horse carrying Clark's field desk rolled down the mountain for 40 yards until it lodged against a tree. The desk was smashed, but the horse was unhurt. When the party reached the ridgeline, at some 7,000 feet of elevation, There was no water. Using snow, the men made a soup out of the remains of the colt killed the previous day. The expedition had made only 12 miles despite the greatest exertion. Even more discouraging, Clark wrote that, "From this mountain I could observe high, rugged mountains in every direction as far as I could see." There was no way the party was going to cross them in two more days. September 16th was the worst day the expedition had experienced to date. It began to snow 3 hours before dawn and continued all day, piling up to from 6 to 8 inches deep. Clark walked in front to find the trail and found great difficulty in keeping it because of the snow. The pine trees were covered with snow that fell on the men as they passed and brushed the limbs. Clark wrote in his journal, "I have been wet and as cold in every part as I ever was in my life." The party made but 13 miles, passing immense difficult knobs, stones, much falling timber, and immensely steep. The captains ordered a second colt killed, which we all supped heartily on and thought it fine meat. The horses, in a near-starvation situation, strayed during the night, searching for grass. It took the whole morning to find and bring them in. Not until 1 o'clock p.m. did the expedition set out. The road was excessively bad, and the party made only 10 miles. It camped at a sinkhole full of water. The hunters had managed to kill only a few grouse, insufficient for supper. "This compelled us to kill something. A colt being the most useless part of our stock, he fell a prey to our appetites." That was the last of the colts. The captains talked. The men's spirits were low. They were approaching the limits of physical endurance. The food supply was all but gone, and there was no hope of finding game. Lewis and Clark realized that the men, and they themselves, had reached a breaking point. But to retreat was unthinkable. They would rather die than quit, and in any case, impractical, for the 5-day journey back to the Bitterroot River was probably beyond their capabilities. They had to go on. But to do so required desperate measures. The captains concluded that in the morning, Clark would go ahead with 6 hunters. In Lewis's words, "to hurry on to the level country ahead and there hunt and provide some provision to send back to the main party, which would follow under Lewis's leadership." They hated to split up. In the past 17 months, they had done so only during the Marias River exploration and in the search for the Shoshones, especially in these god-awful mountains, with no firm idea as to how far ahead the level country might be. On the morning of September 18th, Clark struck out at first light. That day, Lewis resumed writing in his journal. He had done so only twice in the past 3 weeks for unknown reasons. Evidently, he did so now to maintain a full record of the journey. He ordered the horses brought in early to force my march as much as the abilities of our horses would permit. Unfortunately, Private Alexander Willard allowed his horse to stray. Lewis sent him to search for it while the men ate what was left of the colt for breakfast. At 8:30 a.m., the party got started. Willard rejoined the men late that afternoon without his horse. Lewis made 18 miles that day and camped on the side of a steep mountain. He broke out a scant proportion of the portable soup, a few canisters of which, a little bear's oil and about 20 pounds of candles, form our stock of provision. "The situation was critical," Lewis wrote, "the only recourses being our guns and pack horses." Killing the pack horses would mean abandoning most of the baggage they were carrying, unthinkable with the Pacific still so far away, not to mention the return trip, and the rifles were but a poor dependence in a country where there is nothing upon earth except ourselves and a few small pheasants, grouse, small gray squirrels, and a bluebird of the vulture kind, either the pinion jay or Steller's jay. There was nothing for it but to proceed. In the morning, Lewis got the party going shortly after sunrise. At 6 miles, the ridge terminated at today's Sherman Peak, and we, to our inexpressible joy, discovered a large tract of prairie country lying to the southwest and widening as it appeared to extend to the west. There was an end to the mountains after all. The plain appeared to be 60 miles distant, but old Toby assured Lewis that we should reach its borders tomorrow. The appearance of this country, our only hope for subsistence, greatly revived the spirits of the party already reduced and much weakened for the want of food. Lewis pressed on. The road was excessively dangerous, being a narrow, rocky path generally on the side of steep precipice, from which in many places, if either man or horse were precipitated, they would inevitably be dashed in pieces. Late that afternoon, one horse did fall, and rolled with his load near 100 yards into the creek. We all expected that the horse was killed, but to our astonishment, when the load was taken off him, he arose to his feet and appeared to be but little injured. Lewis commented that this was the most wonderful escape I ever witnessed. The expedition's luck was changing. Only just in time. In addition to all the other problems, several of the men were sick with dysentery, and nearly all of them suffered from breakings out or eruptions of the skin, probably caused by venereal disease contracted from the Shoshone women. The following day, after proceeding 2 miles, Lewis saw a most welcome sight. The greater part of a horse which Captain Clark had met with and killed for us. Clark had also left a note saying he intended to proceed as fast as possible to the plains, where he intended to hunt until Lewis came up. The party made a hearty meal on our horse beef, much to the comfort of our hungry stomachs. But as Lewis ate, he got more bad news. One of the pack horses, with his load, was missing. That load was particularly valuable to Lewis, for it contained his stock of winter clothing. He sent Private Lepage, who was responsible for the horse, back to search for it, but Lepage returned at 3 o'clock p.m. without it. Lewis then sent 2 of my best woodsmen in search of him,